Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In a largely symbolic act, House Republicans voted unanimously to repeal the health care law. Democrats are expected to kill the effort in the Senate. Chinese President Hu Jintao wrapped up a state visit to Washington by urging the U.S. to treat China with respect and as equals. And a presidential executive order will establish a new Council on Jobs and Competitiveness headed by the CEO of GE. Joining me in the studio for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News, and Major Garrett of National Journal. During the hour, we will welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Major Garrett, how much of a success or otherwise would you rate President Hu's visit to Washington and Chicago?
Well, for the Chinese, it was a success because it was a state visit. The Chinese received every protocol deference that they sought from the U.S. government, which is significant because, and Jerry may know this better than I do, but I think this is the first time ever a U.S. president has extended a state visit to a country that is holding a Nobel laureate in prison, Liu Xiaobo. And that is a significant point of friction with the United States and China over human rights. It came up at the press conference, and yet the Chinese sought and received every protocol advantage that they wanted from this state visit. Human rights came up. The biggest issue right now between the United States and China is North Korea. And there's been some movement in the last couple of days. The Chinese have agreed to exert more pressure on North Korea. There's a sense that the talks may restart between the six parties on the North Korea nuclear issue, and that there might be more military-to-military conversations between North Korea and South Korea. This is the number one security issue, and in the last 6 months, the Obama administration has made it abundantly clear in ways it did not before to the Chinese that North Korea is no longer strictly a regional issue. It is an issue of U.S. national security. Ballistic missiles now, according to what Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said on a trip to China, could reach the United States from North Korea in 5 years. It's not just about regional allies and regional power for the United States. It's about our own national security. That's been conveyed. The Chinese have responded. So on that issue, there has been some progress.
Jerry Seib.
Well, I think Major's right. The dynamics of this were much different. When President Hu came in the last days of the – or last year, I think, of the Bush administration, was not accorded the state visit protocols. They would not allow a state dinner. They had a sort of fake state lunch instead. There was a very embarrassing moment at the arrival ceremony where a Falun Gong protester masquerading as a journalist did something that very much upset the Chinese, which was to speak up in protest. There was a lot of tension. There was not much tension this time. It was different, and I think partly it was because I think both sides decided the image they wanted to project was that the two countries are neither friends nor rivals. They're somewhere in between. We acknowledge our problems. We'll deal with them. We're not going to solve them here today. We're not even going to try to solve them here today, but we're going to deal with them, and that's really what the dynamic was all about. And just as a footnote, the other thing that's changed is that in past visits, it tended to be the Chinese coming to ask for something. You know, give us help to get into the World Trade Organization, for example, or give us help with the regional politics. In this case, it was pretty clearly a situation in which the dynamic is reversed, and it's the U.S. asking for help from China. Give us some help on currency. Give us some help on trade. Give us some help on North Korea and Iran.
Lisa Lehrer, what about President Hu's reception on Capitol Hill?
Well, that's a really good point to bring up. I think the reception on Capitol Hill illustrated some of the challenges in this relationship, particularly domestically for President Obama. You know, while they did have this very polite meeting, series of meetings and a big state dinner in the White House, in Congress, it was a much harsher reception. They really, this is political red meat for these guys. We saw a lot of ads, anti-China, China bashing ads run during the election. Some of them were very successful. So Congress had a series of meetings, and the discourse over there was pretty harsh. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid referred to President Hu as a dictator and then tried to dial it back a little bit. So I think the fact how politically potent China bashing can be illustrates the danger for President Obama and how he really has to balance this relationship between, you know, sort of setting a new balance internationally, but also keeping things a little bit, the rhetoric a little bit in line domestically, particularly as they move into the presidential election.
I thought it was interesting that when President Hu was pressed for a response on human rights, that portion of his response was blocked out in China, Major.
Perfectly characteristic of the Chinese government and the Chinese control of the media. When I traveled with President Obama to China, when he last met with President Hu, back when I was covering the White House, there was incredibly strict controls of access. There was a town hall meeting that the president had. There was very strict controls, internet and otherwise, for the Chinese over media access to that. They don't want to discuss human rights in China. They consider the issue of human rights, dissidents imprisoned, to be a state security issue. And what you saw in the statements and what you saw in the toast from President Hu is we respect each other's sovereignty and we do not meddle in each other's internal affairs. What that means in Chinese rhetoric is we will continue our policy of imprisoning dissidents no matter what you say.
But didn't he somewhat dial back on that, Jerry?
He did. He said after giving a fairly standard Chinese government response when asked about human rights, he said one thing very interesting at the end. He said, we have progress yet to be made on human rights.
Right.
It was an admission of a failing of sorts on the human rights question.
And that was
specific.
The part that was blocked out.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But to say it in public before an American audience with the president by his side was significant. I think it wouldn't have been said previously, I think, by this Chinese leader or any other.
Do you believe that this visit is going to have a lasting impact on the relationship between the U.S. and China?
Well, I think it has to. I mean, there are a multitude of issues that can't be ignored. The Chinese recognize that they're not playing by the rules of the global economy and that they have to start doing that. The answer we were just talking about on human rights was a recognition that they know they're going to have to deal with that. There is a sense in this visit that China realizes it has to step up to play a role as a global power if it pretends to be a global power. It was funny because it reminded me a little bit, the atmosphere around town this week, of what it was like in the 90s when Mikhail Gorbachev would come. I mean, everybody was sort of like on the edge of their seats wondering what will happen in these conversations. It was that important. Well, now the Russian leader comes and goes and nobody pays much attention, but the Chinese president shows up and it's the same atmosphere, and that tells you that everybody recognizes this is the preeminent relationship in the world today.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Major Garrett of National Journal, Lisa Lehrer. She's politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Lisa, let's talk about the vote in the House of Representatives on health care. Purely symbolic, or are there some other ramifications we have not yet seen?
Well, this was a purely symbolic vote. Of course, the House voted to repeal the health care law put in place by the last Congress. That's very unlikely to pass the Senate. And even if it did, I can bet you the White House that President Barack Obama is not going to sign that bill. So this was a symbolic vote designed to satisfy the base and fulfill a campaign promise to repeal and replace the law. Now, however, Republicans in the House have to move on to the trickier part of that promise, which is the replace section. And I think there are some political dangers for the party as they start getting into that part of this debate. First of all, most people, I think, polling shows that they're far more interested in the economy and jobs than health care. There isn't a lot of interest in getting really bogged down in another healthcare debate. And I think, and most importantly, the Republican base is less interested in healthcare than Democrats and independents are. So I think there's some danger there. If they really get bogged down in healthcare, they could make the same mistake that Republicans accused Democrats of making this last election, which was ignoring jobs, ignoring the economy to take on this really massive goal.
What about the Senate, Major Garrett? Does the GOP had the tools to force a vote in the Senate.
No, not the tools to force a vote, but it can offer the repeal initiative in any series of amendments it wants to, which would require the Democrats to use procedural tactics to prevent that from happening if they wanted to, and you may see that play itself out. The more important issue for House Republicans who initiated this process, and we're going to be judged now that they have repealed this, is, well, what is your mechanism to replace this law? And the word you hear most constantly used and invoked by House Republicans to describe the process that comes next is methodical. But it's hard to find a method behind the methodical process. They don't have a bill. They don't have an alternative. Even the alternative offered last year in the heat of the Obama healthcare debate, the John Boehner substitute, is not the basis of action now. They're going to basically start from scratch. And that John Boehner alternative extended coverage by 3 million people, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which underscores the philosophical difference Republicans and Democrats have on this issue. Democrats believe you must cover everyone or nearly everyone to lower costs. Republicans believe you have to lower costs, then over time you will achieve expanded coverage. Well, they're going to have to prove legislatively how they seek to accomplish that. They don't have anything on the table yet.
So, Jerry, this goes back to Lisa's point, a division within the Republican Party on what to do next.
Well, a little bit, but also a divided country. You know, I mean, Republicans had to do what they did in the House. You know, we did a poll this week, Journal NBC News poll, that showed that 80%, almost 80% of Republicans wanted to repeal the law. But if you broaden the camera out and look at Americans as a whole, it's split. They're split right down the middle on this question of whether to repeal or not. They're split right down the middle on the question of whether the bill overall was a good idea or not. So there's not a consensus that Republicans can work from or work towards, and they have to resolve that amongst themselves.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Major Garrett of the National Journal, Lisa Lehrer, Bloomberg News. When we come back, we'll talk about the latest polls on the president. Stay with us. And we're back with the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. And certainly this week, looking at these brand new polls that show that President Obama's poll numbers have moved up to the highest since July of 2009. Lisa Lehrer, why do you think that is?
Well, the number that I found really interesting in a lot of these polls was that his support among independents had gone up 10 points since last year. And I think that's something the White House has really consciously worked at. They, starting in the lame duck, really, when they cut a tax deal with Republicans, they've tried to position him as more of an independent. And there was an indication that more voters now view the president as independent versus liberal. And I think that's a message we're going to see the White House continue to push as we move into the 2012 elections and also push strongly in the State of the Union.
And what about how Republicans in Congress are viewed, Jerry?
You know, they've sort of flatlined a little bit since the election, which is probably predictable. I mean, when the party wins a big election, people feel good about it, and then they fall back and they think about it and they feel a little less good or a little less sure. And in our polling this week, that's sort of what you saw. You saw a little bit of a slump in numbers for Republicans. what I thought was most interesting in our poll in the numbers about President Obama was the share of people who considered him now consider him to be a moderate, a political moderate, as opposed to a liberal or a conservative. That's 40% now. It's 10 points higher than it was last year. So the repositioning that he's done since the election wasn't simply to say, I'll work with Republicans. It was to move away from the image he had before, which is somebody who was more liberal, I think, than a lot of voters thought he would be when they voted for him.
Is this all because of the lame duck session, Major?
It's because of the election, first. Elections have consequences, as President Obama famously told Eric Cantor on their first meeting after he won the presidency and was inaugurated. Elections have consequences. The president, to a degree, is liberated in that he has a loyal opposition that he must confront and must deal with. That is now a new political reality. And his Democratic constituency must recognize that. And he's recognizing it first, acting in accordance with that new political reality. The lame duck session produced two things that Republicans sought. A continuing resolution which put off spending decisions for this year until March, giving Republicans a chance to put their own stamp on that, and they got an extension of the Bush tax cuts. Two things inconceivable before the midterm election. The president cut that deal for political and policy reasons. Why? Because on policy, he knew that was the better deal he could cut in the lame duck than any deal he could cut with Republicans in control of the House. The new reality has brought new politics, and that new politics now has more of a Republican tinge, which independents have responded to. And in some of the polling data, you see less of the sharp division in Republicans disliking President Obama. They've narrowed a little bit in that spectrum as well, which has also helped his numbers.
Lisa, what do you think this could mean for the president's State of the Union address?
Well, I think we're certainly going to see. I think the White House realizes that part of these numbers is also tied to the sense that the economy is recovering. But that, you know, that they could also see if people don't see more of an improvement in the unemployment rate, that support could trail off a little bit. Because, of course, the president, when the economy is good, takes credit. And when it's bad, he gets blamed. So I think you're definitely going to see a focus on job creation rather than sort of saving the economy, moving into a place where we're now creating new jobs. And I think you're also going to see the other thing that people indicated in those polls that they liked was a change in tone in Washington. So you probably will see some focus on that, reaching a new civility. I think you're seeing a bit of a bounce from the speech he gave in Arizona. So, you know, you'll continue to see those themes in the State of the Union.
Jerry.
I think the red flag in this, I think Lisa just referred to it, for the White House has got to be the rise in these polls of unemployment as the issue. The healthcare debate, as we were discussing, has fallen as a priority. Even the deficit seems to be dropping a little bit. There is this intense focus on jobs. People think the economy is getting a little better. They want the proof to be creation of jobs. That's the danger, I think, for the president here, because it is very hard for him to control the unemployment rate, try as they might. And it's very likely it's not going to get a lot better anytime soon. And so I think there's the potential for a fallback here when people are disappointed by lack of progress on unemployment.
So what signal is the president sending by replacing Paul Volcker with GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt?
Well, he's sending a signal that he's recasting this panel that was looking into economic recovery into a council on jobs and competitiveness, the key word there being jobs. And that goes back to what we were just talking about. It's a signal that I'm going to bring in business people, business minds, and we're going to work together on creating jobs. We're not going to fight with each other over why jobs aren't being created, which was kind of the tenor of last year. Is it symbolic? Yeah. Is it important symbolism? Maybe. We'll see.
Lisa.
Well, it's also a continuation of the White House's effort to court business and court CEOs. They definitely had a problem within a perception problem, at the very least, within the business community, where a lot of CEOs were very unhappy with the White House, felt that they were ignoring their concerns. So by putting Jeffrey Immelt in there in this job, it's a very high-profile position, perhaps symbolic, but it's a very high-profile place to have a CEO. And Immelt was not always a supporter of the Obama administration. He gave donations to the McCain campaign. He gave donations to Hillary Clinton's campaign. But since the Obama administration began, he's become a lot more supportive of the president. He was there during the visit from the Chinese president. So putting him in this place is part of that campaign.
Paul Volcker was brought into the Obama world as a wise man, an economic wise man, a verifier, for those who were skeptical about the Obama approach to economics during the campaign. Jeff Immelt is an action man, and that's the big difference. He's in the fray right now. He's developing new ideas, new concepts, and all of that is the transition from wise man to action man on the economy. And I think that's the best way to describe
Interesting.
It.
Interesting. I want to ask you all about Daryl Issa, who has repeatedly promised to investigate this administration. This week, the New Yorker profiled Daryl Issa, and it talked about past troubles. What did you think about those past troubles and how they might have an impact or reflect on what his intention is as far as the president?
Diane, I cannot do justice to Ryan Liz's work in The New Yorker here, and I urge anyone who's curious about this topic to go to The New Yorker website and read it. It's a phenomenal piece of journalism. And those of us in California, who are from California as I am, or who covered the recall election for Gray Davis, have read a lot of these stories before because they were brought up when Daryl Issa was bankrolling the recall effort against Democratic Governor Gray Davis in the late 90s, which produced the Arnold Schwarzenegger governorship. In a nutshell, as a young man, Daryl Issa had a lot of scrapes with the law, and most of them involving his brother, William. Allegations of car theft, and as a business owner, very contentious, unresolved. Well, resolved in the courts, he was never charged, but there continues to be friction between him and former business partners as to whether or not he might have been involved in arson of a building or a company that he owned. There was a lot of suspicious activity, some of which he explained, some of which Liz left unexplained, about what he did before that fire. Like I said, no charges ever brought in many of these instances. If things were adjudicated, they were handled in a way that minimized the damage to Daryl Issa's reputation then, and have not harmed him in the main in his political career going forward. The sum total of Ryan Liz's piece is that this experience, having been investigated as a young man and having these issues continue to dog and revisit him as a politician, may make him more cautious or at least more reflective about subpoena power and the abuse thereof, or the fear of abuse in the hands of Republican oversight investigators, and he is the chairman of that committee.
At the same time, he's made clear his intention to investigate or have hearings on the Obama administration, 7 hearings a week times 40 weeks. Lisa.
That's exactly right, and I agree with Major. This was really just a devastating piece for Daryl Issa. It wasn't necessarily new information. I think a lot of folks, certainly in California, but also on Capitol Hill, knew about a lot of these accusations. But I can tell you from talking to Republican aides that having them laid out in this piece that got an awful lot of attention caused some screaming in the Republican leadership offices. This is something that Republican leadership, it's a concern they've had for a long time with Daryl Issa. He's known as someone who really likes the spotlight. And, you know, and they made that clear in the profile. He worked hard to raise his Washington profile by saying things, you know, playing to some more inflammatory statements. And that was a concern for Republican leadership because they're really worried that this committee will turn into a witch hunt. And they think that that's something that could hurt Republicans in the 2012 elections if they look like, while the economy is dealing with a 9.4 unemployment rate, Daryl Issa is wasting people's time by having sort of, you know, investigations that aren't really, don't seem really driven by the issues. So they've been sort of trying to push him to take a very measured tone, and I don't think this profile helps build any confidence that that'll happen among Republican leaders.
Jerry.
You know, I think the one of the effects of this, though, might actually be beneficial to Republicans, because I think it probably compels Daryl Issa, even more than I think he was already inclined, to make the focus of what he's doing things that are happening now, not things that happened before. You know, there was the precedent for this was Dan Burton, who was a conservative Republican who ran the same committee in the Clinton years, and he spent a lot of time going back and looking at the Whitewater scandal and things that happened in Arkansas and things about the backgrounds of the president, his aides, his wife. And ultimately, I think Republicans felt that hurt them. Yes, President Clinton got impeached, but there was a sense that there was a kind of a witch hunt going on, and lo and behold, you know, President Clinton wins a, you know, smashing reelection in 1996. I think that Daryl Issa had already probably decided, because of the way he set up his hearing schedule, that he was going to look at things that are happening now and more policy-oriented things, not personal things. And I suspect that this kind of publicity makes that even more likely.
One quick note, Diane. I wrote in National Journal 2 weeks ago that picking up on Lisa's point, the level of concern about not only Darrell Issa but all the oversight processes is very high in Speaker Boehner's office, and they are looking for and trying to find, and it's not a particularly easy person to find, an oversight overseer, someone who from the Speaker's office coordinates and sits on these chairmen who are running oversight, A, that they don't overlap, B, that they don't spend a lot of time on past issues that are not relevant to the economic equation or discussion, and C, produce results. And D, don't put Republicans in the posture of saying, welcome to the committee, Mr. Witness, you're guilty. Now here's my first question, which has been the tactic principally used by Republicans before, personified most memorably by Dan Burton, but other Republicans have fallen into that trap too. Allegations first, questions later. And the Republican leadership wants oversight to create results that lead to legislative products that change policy, which is a different approach than Republicans have used in the past.
I must say I was particularly struck by the chutzpah that Darrell Issa and his brother must have had back in March of 1972 when they were arrested and charged with stealing a red Maserati from a Cleveland showroom. Who of us hasn't looked yearningly at a car like that? But who's had the nerve to steal it from a showroom? We shall see. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think it's interesting that Joe Lieberman has announced his retirement, says he won't seek a fifth term in the Senate. Was that a surprise to anyone?
Not to me. It was going to be a very difficult reelection. He was going to have to run as an independent, or if he chose to try to run as a Democrat, he was going to get a primary challenge. There was going to be a significant Republican opposition. It was going to be a much tougher road. And I think Joe Lieberman looks to the next 2 years and has come up to the conclusion, as many already have, perhaps prematurely, that not much is going to happen. It's going to be a lot of very aggressive back and forth, but not a lot of work product. And if you're summing up or culminating a senatorial career and you've played an enormous pivotal role in something like the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, why not leave on a high note? I think he did.
Lisa.
I think he also looked at some of what happened during the 2010 elections. You know, I'm thinking of former Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who tried to mount an independent bid for governor after he was pushed out. He wouldn't have won the Republican primary when he was challenged by a candidate with a lot of Tea Party support. And that did not go very well for the former Florida governor. I think it's always been hard to run as an independent. You don't have the fundraising backing, the grassroots volunteer backing of both parties. But I have to wonder if that's gotten a little bit harder over the past election cycle, the past couple of years, as it seems like voters have grown a lot more polarized, and certainly in primaries, but maybe in the general election as well.
And you've also had the announcements of Kay Bailey Hutchison and Kent Conrad.
Right, and one is a safe seat for her party, Kay Bailey Hutchison's in Texas. One, Kent Conrad for the Democrats, is not safe. So Democrats look at this picture and they say, we're actually glad, we're relieved that Joe Lieberman is retiring. We think that gives us a chance to save that seat. They look at Conrad and they're, I think despair is too long a word, but too strong a word, but I don't think there's much optimism they can hang on to that seat.
And they do. They certainly look at the 2012 landscape in the Senate and know they have a pretty tough year ahead of them. There are 23 Democratic seats that Democrats will, or 23 seats that Democrats will have to defend. Republicans are only going to have to defend 10, and some of those are in seats like Kent Conrad's that are going to be tough for them to hold.
Now, this week, and certainly in the past few weeks, there's been a lot of talk about civility. There has also, because it's the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's speech, his inaugural speech, so many people have concentrated on ask not what your country can do for you. But there was another portion of that speech that I was particularly interested in, and I'd like you to hear it now.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof.
What'd you make of that, Jerry? Well, in today's parlance.
Well, in today's parlance, it's it's striking given the debate that's going on, but it's also very similar to themes that Barack Obama struck in his inaugural address that didn't lead to much civility, frankly. So, you know, maybe it's a different time, or maybe we remember more civility in the past than really was there. I struggled with that question myself a fair amount. Was it as civil in the past as we think it was? I think it was more civil, but maybe it wasn't quite as civil as we think. But I do think that there is a broader problem here in Washington, which is partly related to the tenor of the debate, but also partly related to what the debate produces, which is, even if you have a rancorous debate, I think there was a tendency 20 or 25 years ago to, at the end of the day, to decide the debate was over and then come together and figure out a solution. Now I think we have the rancorous debate and no desire to come together and have a solution at the end of the day, and that's the real problem that I see.
Major.
There's a context for that inaugural address, of course. It was an incredibly close presidential election, and there were some Republicans who took on Richard Nixon and said, you should challenge this result. It was so close. Look at Cook County. Look at Illinois. And in the context of what the times that President Kennedy was talking about, there was an agreement between these two very arch rivals politically to not have and not put the country through that. He was a benefactor in a very small way of a display of civility and a larger sense of what America ought to be about in the future. And he was trying to extend that forward.
Jerry Garrett and Jerry Seib, also Lisa Lehrer. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Leading Arab nations suspend efforts to help Lebanon end the government crisis. Iraq is shaken by a sharp spike in violence. And South Korea agrees to military talks with the North. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've got lots of callers waiting, including Sam in Birmingham, Hamish in Illinois, Frank in Charlotte. We'll try to get to all of you. First to Sam in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to have a question about this, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And I'm for repeal of the act, just to let you know my bias. But at any rate, I was wondering, in the law itself, is there any severability provisions, which is something that would say if any part of the law was repealed, invalidated, determined unconstitutional, that the remainder of the law would continue valid, or was that left out of the law? Does any of your guests know that?
Jerry.
I don't know, but I don't believe so. And I think that's the backdrop of the debate about the legal challenges right now, because the main legal challenge to the law is a challenge to the individual mandate. There's part of the law that says everybody in the country is required, essentially everybody in the country is required to acquire health insurance one way or the other. Much of the debate is about whether if you take that out in the courts, can the rest of the bill stand? But that's not because it would be legally invalid, but because practically the individual mandate is very important to making many other parts work correctly and to save money in the Democrats' view.
Here's an email from Elizabeth, who says, I take issue with your panelist who claims the GOP doesn't have a replacement plan in place. My understanding is Republicans have an alternative health care proposal and it's been scored by the CBO.
Yes, that's correct. They do have an alternative. It is not the alternative. It is not the operating alternative that Republicans will use going forward to replace the President's Health Care Reform Act. I talked to Kevin McCarthy yesterday on the phone. It's in National Journal today. He's the House Majority Whip. He said, look, nothing is predetermined and everything is very broad. The House Republicans, with their power yesterday, passed a resolution setting out about 12 priorities for this replace legislation. They're all extremely broad. And I asked Kevin McCarthy and I've asked senior House Republican leaders, does the Boehner alternative, the one produced by House Republicans last year, form the basis of your new approach? Maybe yes, maybe no. I said, what about the McCain proposal from the 2008 campaign, which would have ended tax subsidization for business-sponsored health insurance coverage in exchange for rebates to individual consumers to buy their own health insurance on the open market? Hasn't come up at all. So the Boehner alternative is there, but it's not central. And the McCain idea, the last big idea Republicans have had, fully debated in a national campaign on health care, hasn't come up in the conversation. So
Lisa,
it's all very broad.
I think it's also important to think about what the Republicans are doing in terms of replacement legislation, in terms of the process a little bit. They had a press conference of the four committee chairmen who are going to be in charge of drafting this bill yesterday, and they really stressed that this is going to be a piecemeal approach. This isn't going to be done how the Democrats do it, where you create this big bill and try to get it through Congress as this massive undertaking. They don't want to get involved with that. They criticize Democrats for that. They're going to do a series of smaller bills.
And weren't those smaller bills identical to provisions that are currently in the administration?
Well, some will be and some won't be. For example, there will probably be a bill that allows people to sell insurance across state lines. That's in the large legislation. There'll also probably be a bill that constructs barriers to malpractice lawsuits against doctors. That will go well beyond what's in the legislation.
And what about allowing up to 26-year-olds to stay on parents' policies and to allow for pre-existing conditions?
Well, certainly allowing kids to stay on until they're 26, that's wildly popular. I don't think anybody will mess with that. Pre-existing conditions, I think, will be a subject of debate.
I think taking up the bill this way, this piecemeal approach, could make it awfully hard for Republicans to achieve their larger policy goals. They say that this is about lowering costs. If you lower costs, more uninsured people will buy insurance and buy into the system. But the fact of the matter is health costs are accelerating faster than wages. So getting costs lower, low enough that people can afford health care, I think is going to be really hard unless you take over. They're going to find out what Democrats found out, which is that this is really hard unless you deal with the whole system.
So just to clarify, Major, there is no total Republican bill.
No, and there's no intention to create an omnibus or super large legislative remedy. And there's no timeline either. This will not, you will not see these four committees of jurisdiction produce anything of a substantial nature for
All
months
right.
and months.
To Concord, New Hampshire. Good morning, Joe.
Hello. Yeah, I just want to make a comment. Earlier, someone had talked about polls that show roughly 50-50 for repealing health care legislation versus keeping it. I've seen a number of other polls that are more detailed, I think more comprehensive. And, saying 50-50 gives the impression that half the country wants to have the government get out of the health care business. But, in fact, many of those saying repeal according to many polls, are people who want the government to do more, want a public option, or want Medicare for everybody.
Certainly depends on how the question is asked, Lisa.
Well, I think the caller is right. The polling I've seen has shown that only 18% or so of people favor total repeal, and 37% favor, you know, including additional, that brings it up to 37% favor repealing some of the provisions. So people are divided on whether they approve, whether they like the law. But in terms of repealing it, I think overall people are not that keen to repeal it. However, when you look at Republicans, that number goes up significantly. A majority of Republicans favor repeal.
And to Sycamore, Illinois. Good morning, Hamish.
Good morning. My comment is we the people are so tired of them fighting each other. They need to fix the problems, not put Band-Aids on them. And if they don't do this, I do believe that the President of the United States has the right to call them back into session until they do. And that's basically it. Thank you.
All right. Jerry.
Well, there's a voice from the election of 2010 right there, I think. You know, fix the problem seems to be. And I think this goes back to something both Major and Lisa were referring to earlier, that there is kind of a change in the approach here. There is a kind of a more let's get this solved attitude in Washington for now. And we'll see after the president makes a State of the Union address and presents a budget and Republicans have a budget, how long that lasts. And I don't think it's all because of the Arizona shooting. I do think there's a change in tone right now. And I think, you know, again, as Major said, the president has been able to reposition himself to break loose from his party a little bit because of the results. And I think the net effect is a little bit more pragmatic approach for now.
The fact of the matter is, though, I think when we talk about change in tone, return to civility in politics, is that the inflammatory tone works in a lot of ways for politicians. We live in an era of a 24-hour news cycle. I don't want to blame it on the media with all of us here on the panel. But, I mean, when politicians make these kinds of inflammatory statements, it appeals to their base. It fires up their base. It drives fundraising. It raises their profile, you know, because a lot of it's repeated over and over and over again. I mean, you just look at someone like Michelle Bachmann, who's known for making those kinds of statements. And I believe she's in Iowa today doing some, you know, and people are speculating whether she's going to run for president. So for politicians, a lack of stability can really help them. It can work for them.
On the get it done front, the president has told his economic advisors he would like ideas that excite him. There are some very serious structural issues with the U.S. economy right now. The president talked in North Carolina last during the campaign about a Sputnik moment, that we need to find a way to move beyond the economic destiny or track of this country for the past 10 or 15 years, built on credit and consumption. That's a huge transformation of this U.S. economy. And with unemployment at 9.4%, dropping largely because people have given up trying to find work, and the structural long-term unemployment, longer than we've seen since the Great Depression, these issues are very, very difficult to resolve. And you had a big tax package in the lame duck. I'm not sure we're going to see another similarly large idea worth that much money for the U.S. economy, nearly $800 billion. So the get-it-done spirit, I agree with Jerry, is here. The how-to-get-it-done is a bit more elusive.
And now to Leslie in Pembroke Pines, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Delighted. Thank you so much indeed. As brief as possible, it's about the U.S.-China relationship. Both our presidents, you and Obama, they speak about respect for each other, which I do agree with. But it goes beyond that. Respect means that we should not intimidate, as we have been doing lately, with our military around the shores of China and other places. We speak about harnessing North Korea, which I do agree with. How about we harnessing Israel also, who have committed many atrocities? Madam, I could go on and on, but there are too many things at this point to mention. I wish to your panel to answer these questions.
Thank you. Jerry.
Well, I don't think there's an issue of military intimidation between the U.S. and China right now. I think there is an issue of whether there can be meaningful military cooperation, which there has been, and then it broke down because of a U.S. arms sale to Taiwan last year. And this was did not get a lot of attention this week, but it's a very important part of the dialogue, is to rebuild that military-to-military cooperation precisely so that there will not be military confrontation or intimidation. The fact is China is a rising power in Asia, and it's a rising military power as well as economic power. Everybody acknowledges that, and the U.S. wants to have a system for dealing with it.
To Susan in Calvert County, Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is about the president's visit with President Hu. We hear a lot from the media about what we asked of the of President Hu and of the Chinese. And my question is, well, what did the Chinese ask of us?
Well, one of the things they asked for is for less hectoring about their economic policies and understanding that they can't make adjustments very quickly in, for example, the level of their currency rate, because they have a big complicated economy and a developing nations economy, not a developed nations economy. And one of the things they didn't say very much but that they complain about is that the Federal Reserve policy on this side of the equation, by holding interest rates at essentially zero, is creating inflation in China and is creating a lot of cheap money that's flooding into China and driving up real estate and maybe creating the kind of real estate bubble in China that we just saw punctured in the U.S. So they have some complaints, too. They just didn't get as much attention this week.
Right. Don't badger us on human rights. Don't badger us on currency. Don't badger us on trade access. And don't badger us on intellectual property. Well, the last three all have to do with the economic future of many American jobs, so the badgering will continue. One thing I think is interesting is the Chinese assumed with the midterm elections and Republicans gaining control of the House, the currency issue would die down. I would say it's not front and center for House Republicans, but it has not died down, and many House freshmen are energized on that issue in ways that will come to surprise unpleasantly the Chinese.
Major Garrett, he's congressional correspondent for the National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Southeast Michigan. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Just a brief comment. I have yet to hear anybody call it what I think it actually is. The House vote to repeal health care was about the most shameless bit of political pandering I've ever seen.
And that's your comment. What do you think, Major?
Well, I'm sure he believes exactly what he said. Bob, you're not alone. Many Democrats believe that. The White House wouldn't describe it that way publicly, but I'm sure there are one or two people who work for the president who would share your characterization. Bob obviously likes what is in law and wants to see it implemented. Republicans don't. They don't want to see it implemented. And the next stage of this, in addition to whatever policy Republicans put forward to replace, there are going to be very intense battles over the purse strings of the money that's required to build the infrastructure to actually implement what remains, and there's a substantial bit that remains, of the president's health care law, and that's where the next battle will be fought.
I mean, this was a symbolic vote. It's not going to, they're not going to, the likelihood of this law actually getting repealed is very, very, very small, if not non-existent. But it was a vote Republicans had to take. This is something they promised to do over and over and over and campaign across the country. So they had to show the base that they were going to do it when they
but
got
Jerry,
power.
But, Jerry, you do have 26 states now who have voted to, whose courts have said this law is unconstitutional. This has got to go to the Supreme Court. What happens in the meantime? I mean, most of the law does not go into effect until 2014. Will the courts be finished with it? Will it be at the Supreme Court by 2014?
Well, two things will happen. There will continue to be a political debate about this bill for the next 2 years because, as you say, it's not really implemented until 2014, and that was by design. And secondly, meantime, I do think the courts will probably resolve this issue by 2012, and that will be a big moment. Honestly, even the people who wrote this bill said in 2009 and 2010 that no piece of social legislation this big is written and then implemented as written. It's inevitably going to be tinkered around with for years and years, as was Social Security, as was Medicare. So that's the process we're going through on a minor scale. On a major scale, it's a national debate that will be carried through the 2012 election. And so it's messy. And I, you know, pandering, I don't know. I mean, people, you know, as Lisa said, had a commitment to have this vote, and they did it. Votes have consequences, as we were saying before. And people who wanted to be on the record as being for or against this legislation now are on the record, and people can make their own conclusions accordingly. accordingly.
And Major Garrett, I cannot let you go without asking you about the mention of the possibility that you might replace Gibbs as spokesperson for the White House.
Yes.
I mean, we hear you laughing.
Yes, I am laughing. It's I was in the Washington Post. It has not been repeated anywhere else. That's one thing that gives you an idea of the short arm of the great mentioner in this case. I'd never had the short arm of the great mentioner fall upon my shoulder before. It's an alarming thing. The White House has never talked to me. I can predict with absolute certainty the White House will never talk to me about this. And it's not going to happen. It was, in general, a compliment. The White House respects my journalism. I'm respected by my colleagues. I take the compliment, and that's as far as it goes.
How many others?
Oh, you didn't ask me whether I'm interested or not.
Are you?
No.
Well, we shall watch this space and see what happens. Jerry Seib, The Wall Street Journal, Lisa Lehrer, Bloomberg News, Major Garrett, of National Journal, and who knows what else. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.